My name's Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. We are so happy to be back. We have a wonderful lineup this spring, opening tonight with, of course, Joseph D. Kettner II, who's the curator of the Modern's next exhibition, Andy Warhol, The Last Decade. And then next week, I want to go ahead and let you know that Gabriel Acevedo Velarde will be here for the Focus exhibition. This is our second Focus exhibition, and of course his work is featured in that exhibition, and that opens on February 20th. I encourage you to come. There's a performance involved, and that's all I will tell you. So put that on your calendars. Also check the rest of the schedule out on the Modern's website, where you will also find an interesting selection of programs specifically designed for this exhibition. So I encourage you to do that. There's a lot going on. I don't want you to miss anything because you didn't know about it. That programming includes weekly tours of the show by 14 different artists. I think it should be fascinating if you think about it. 14 different perspectives on Andy Warhol and on this particular body of work. These tours are off to a great start this coming Sunday at 1 p.m. with the artist Richard Patterson. I think a lot of you know Richard. He is from London, but currently living and working in Dallas. I invite you to check out the entire impressive and varied list of artists. Find ones you know. Find out about the ones you don't know. And then decide to be here every week. Make it one of your weekly outings, like Tuesday evenings. Let's see. This Sunday, I also wanted you to know that it being Valentine's Day and also being the official opening of Andy Warhol, The Last Decade, the Cafe Modern is serving a special brunch. So all of your needs are taken care of. Good food, good art, good discourse. So you want to come and be part of the excitement. And as you know, since it is the reason you're here tonight, we are in for a real treat this evening as well. We have the ultimate authority, short of Andy Warhol and maybe including Andy Warhol, on this intriguing exhibition that champions the artist, perhaps less known but most mature and talented. That offers a complex collection of paintings, which, while contributing to and extending the story of Andy Warhol, are quite compelling in their own right. Joe opens his acknowledgments in the exhibition catalog with a story that immediately establishes his feeling for the work of Andy Warhol, in which he compares his own up-close encounter with Warhol's Saturday disaster to the conversion of St. Paul on the road to Damascus. I'm always bolstered when someone with Joe's experience can be so moved, and Joe's experience is vast. He is currently the Henry and Louis Foster Chair in Contemporary Art, Distinguished Curator in Residence at Emerson College in Boston. He has worked for the past 30 years as a museum curator and director specializing in modern and contemporary art, as well as 19th century American art. And as you know, Joe was the chief curator at the Milwaukee Art Museum, where he curated and organized Andy Warhol, The Last Decade. Prior to his post in Milwaukee, he was the director of the Rose Art Museum at Brandeis University, where he had that encounter with the Saturday disaster, as well as having been the director of the Washington University Gallery of Art in St. Louis, now the Mildred Kemper Museum. Joe has curated, organized, and published catalogs on many exhibitions, including Elusive Signs, Bruce Nauman Works in Light in 2006, Roxy Payne, Second Nature, 2002, A Gallery of Modern Art at Washington University in St. Louis in 1994, and the emergence of the African-American artist Robert S. Duncanson, who lived 1821 through 1872. That show was in 1993. Such a career has assured Joe many personal and rewarding relationships with important contemporary artists, which has positioned him to do the exhibitions he's done and to publish related books and catalogs, both of which have been recognized with awards and distinctions from the American Association of Museums, the American Library Association, and the International Association of Art Critics. Joe's accomplishments reflect his dedication, and tonight we are very fortunate to have him here with us to give his presentation, Who is Andy Warhol? Please join me in welcoming Joseph Kettner.
Thank you. I want to do that sound test again. Can you hear me clearly? Okay, good. Now, it is true, I am a recovering museum director, and I can't tell you how expensive my therapy bills are to get me through this. Now that I'm in the academic world, it's very much different, I must confess. See, I knew that would happen. How about that? It's very much different in the academic world. Can you still hear me? Yeah, okay. Well, I'm not going to sit still. So this thing's going to feed back through the course of the next, I'm told, 60 minutes. Can you sit 60 minutes and listen to me for 60 minutes? The students have to sit and listen to me for 2 hours. And when I talk to them about Andy Warhol, and I say, who is Andy Warhol? The first thing they say is, Campbell's Soup. The second thing they say is, Maryland. Well, if there's any point to this exhibition, it is that Andy Warhol is as misunderstood as he is famous. I mean, after all, we're talking about a guy who worked over four decades, and soup cans in Maryland were created both in 1962. I think there's something else to look at. But there's no denying the fact that he is the Prince of Pop. I'm sorry, Michael Jackson, but you have been preceded by someone who gave us this pantheon of pictures that really became the icons of American consumer culture in the 1960s. Very bold, simple images of soup, cereal, and celebrities participated in the pop art revolution that really was the transformation of the art world from the millennia-old idea that a work of art was the touch of an artist's hand to the notion that a work of art could be the manipulation of the mediated image through mechanical reproduction. And Andy Warhol was at the center of that, giving us such stars as Marilyn by rummaging through the magazine, films, and television and selecting key objects that he felt really represented our moment in time. And through these objects, Warhol portrays a post-war America at the height of our political and economic might in a period of explosive economic growth that was the envy of the world. Andy Warhol was at the forefront of pop art, and pop art was a very American phenomenon. But Andy Warhol dug deeper. He scraped away at the surface of this new America to reveal our darker side, the debris of our culture, where we had littered our verdant landscape. You remember those 19th century American landscapes? You can see them over here at the Amon Carter Museum. He presents an America that's not beautiful and green and lush with all of nature's bounty, but one that's also littered with strewn with the wreckage of our car crashes, suicide jumping from buildings, dangerous criminal, and state-sanctioned executions in the electric chair. He is able to navigate that distance between the proud consumer culture, the acquisitiveness of all that's around us, and the darker side underneath that, the negative aspects of that. Not only did Warhol create works of art, but equally important was he created a persona that set trends in art, music, society, and fashion in the 1960s. His eccentric personality, to put it mildly, and his entourage of acolytes captured media attention because of their lifestyle in Warhol's factory, where he would sit on his stool and oversee as both the voyeur and the provocateur of a legion of reckless bohemian excess that unfolded before him. Transgender charade, sexual liberation, drugs, alcohol, and a menagerie of the absolute tumultuous abandon that was the 1960s. He was able, through his art and his personality, to do something no one else could. He could fuse high art with low culture, high society with the avant-garde, in such a way that he influenced the way we see and think about ourselves, and he influenced the work of artists for generations to come. He was not a simple individual. He was a very complex and complicated person. He's a man who embodies contradiction and paradox in his art and in his lifestyle. Here's a fellow who spends his career socializing in the New York club scene with celebrities, but in reality, he lived a quiet, private life. He would go home to his fashionable Upper East Side townhouse where he lived quietly with his mother, and almost no one was permitted to go there. That private Warhol was vastly different from the very public one we know. He sought the celebrity. He claimed that his ambition in life was for fame, but at the same time, he led a very guarded, private, personal life that very, very few people saw. In his interviews, we've heard him speak. He could say just perfectly boring, banal answers. Yeah, wow. Gee, isn't that great? And on the other hand, he could say things that were eminently quotable, like, I'll be your mirror, that were profound and piercing. His artwork reflects these same sorts of contrasts. Here we have Andy Warhol, who will publicly proclaim to be every man, dealing with Coke, hamburgers, and chicken noodle soup. He championed art as commerce. He began as a commercial artist in New York. He always talked about his factory as being a place of production, and later in life, he dealt with the notion of commerce and commercial art as essential to his artistic production. But at the same time, he always identified himself as a painter, and he always aspired to have his work being compared to the great artists in the history of art. And you can see this most clearly when you look at his serious subject, death, religion, and politics. Interestingly, while the pop art revolution was directly contradiction of the abstract expressionists, Andy Warhol emulated them and admired them as much as he was trying to rebel against the touch, the subjective touch of the abstract expressionist. In his statements, he could say, on the one hand, that his paintings were, and I quote him, a statement of the symbols of the harsh, impersonal products and brash materialistic objects on which America is built today, and then turn right around and tell you, if you want to know all about Andy Warhol, just look at the surface of my paintings, my films, and me, and there I am. There's nothing behind it. Well, so which Warhol do we believe? Is it the wispy doyen who sits on his chair overlooking the reckless abandon that's going on in the factory in front of him? Or is he this ghostly death mask, the specter of the socialite that we've come to expect from Andy Warhol? He is both, and he is rich and complex enough to embody both. Warhol's pop art resonated internationally. Everybody in the world recognized the work. And in fact, if you were to think about it, who would be the artist that most everybody would know? One of them would have to be Andy Warhol. Even if people were completely out of touch with the idea of art, people would know who Andy Warhol is. They would recognize his face, they would know his name, and they sure as shootin' have seen Campbell's Soup and Marilyn. It's interesting. tens of thousands of books have been published on Andy Warhol. He is the single most written about artist in the history of art, whether it is serious art history or if it's just the tabloids and social magazine talking about his many exploits, or you can still read an interview today, tales of what we did with Andy Warhol. Look in the bookshop over here. You'll see many. There are literally hundreds of books and articles on Warhol every year. I'm trying to keep up with this bibliography. It's impossible to do. And in preparation for this, I did something that as a good academic, I should never do. I Googled him. 6,790,000 plus hits. This is one of the single most best known artist of all time. Yet for a guy whose career spanned four decades, why do we only know about the work that comes between the four-year period of 1962 and 1968? I asked myself the question, what did he do the other 36 years anyway? And as Andrea told you, she stole some of my story, Andrea. I did have this revelation. I was interviewing for the job to be the director of Brandeis. Have you ever been in a painting storage room? Many of you probably haven't been. I can assure you they're jam-packed, incredibly crowded spaces. And I'm looking over the collection, and the preparator pulls out the screen right in front of my face. I'm not a foot or two away. And in front of my face is hanging this dead body on a 12 foot tall. It's actually about that size, maybe even larger. It's right in my face. I had to stand back and to take it in. I was reeling from the shock of having this corpse dangling in front of my eyes. And I realized at that point, yes, I've seen car crashes, I've seen electric chairs, but I'd never had my nose thrust in it quite so literally. And at that point, I realized I needed to do a project on Andy Warhol because this had so moved me. And what happened was over a period of years, I did some visiting lecturers in the catalog Raisin A authors, a man named Neil Prince. I had him come to Brandeis as a visiting scholar for a semester. He researched the collection, and he and I had a series of conversations. And I was asking him about all these questions surrounding this. Neil himself had done the original Disasters exhibition at the Menil collection in 1987. And that's when he reminded me that the Last Supper painting also are a subject of death. And that's the point at which I began to look backwards to find how did Andy Warhol get to this point that we know so little about. And over the course of a decade, came upon this idea for this exhibition. Now, interestingly, on my working my way back, there are landmarks in the Andy Warhol story that are really quite amazing. You know, in 1965, at the height of his fame, when he was showing his flowers pictures in Paris, at the opening, he pulled a publicity stunt and said he was retiring from painting to concentrate on films. He wasn't going to paint anymore. Well, we know this is not true. But then again, he had this major encounter with Valerie Solanas, a disgruntled factory acolyte who shot him in June 1968. At the time he was shot, Andy Warhol was at the height of his popularity and critical attention. And in fact, in the summer of 1971, Warhol's first retrospective had been traveling around Europe and came to the Whitney Museum, and John Cannaday, that staid New York Times reviewer, some of us here will remember him, some of you are wondering who I'm talking about, wrote, and this is a guy you would not expect to like Warhol, wrote, "The Warhol show is spectacularly installed. The plain, inescapable fact," he admits begrudgingly, "will give pain to his enemies, is that Andy looks better than he has ever looked before." The art world was celebrating Andy Warhol, and he was turning around. This shock, and you can see the wounds of the shock. He said at a later date, hanging around all those weird people, I really just had to change. And indeed, he did. The 1970s is a period of time that marked the transformation of the factory into the office, where Andy and Vincent Fremont, who I believe is on the do you have a little thing that talks to people when they look at the show?
No.
You didn't get that? Darn. Oh, well. Vincent Fremont and Fred Hughes literally ran Andy Warhol Enterprises. They started Interview Magazine. They were producing films. They were entering into all kinds of print ventures. But the biggest business of the 1970s was painting portraits of the wealthy and the celebrities. But even that he grew tired of, to a point where in 1978 he has a major change. And we read about this in 1980. Someone writes an article in Art News. It's called, Gee, What Happened to Andy Warhol? At this point, Warhol is at the very depth of his critical reception. People were sick and tired of all these portraits of the wealthy, his clubbing at night in high society, his appearance in all of the social magazine and gossip tabloids. Andy says to the interviewer in 1980, the 70s were sort of quiet. I think the 80s are going to be more exciting. In the 70s, nothing really different happened in art. And he longed for that something different. And that different thing was motivated I'm not there yet. Scratch, insert paragraph. Forget I said that. We're not at 1977 yet. But what he did do, he continued, despite his transformation, to create Warhol TV. He began to become a fashion model. He put himself, can you imagine this guy as a fashion model? As someone that one 1970s New York socialite described as a really creepy character? Well, yes, and he made a huge business out of this. And in fact, beginning at this point in time, Andy Warhol produced over half of his total print output. This period of 1978 forward is quite possibly, quite undoubtedly, the busiest, most productive period of his entire career. It starts, though, with a period of self-doubt. Now, again, some of us here will understand this, some of us yet won't. But in 1978 of August, Andy Warhol turns 50. He begins that process of examining his own life, asking himself, and in his diaries he quite literally does, begins to ask himself, well, what have I done? What have I accomplished to this point? And he was a person as possessed with self-doubt as he was with public self-confidence. And he decided in these, you can see in these self-portraits, this isn't the same guy who is sitting on the stool with his sunglasses, oh, so hip, looking out at the bohemian 1960s in front of him, but someone with a confused sense of a self-identity. He goes so far in this series of 1978 self-portraits, the first in over a decade that he created, to create these strangulations and self-portraits with skulls, portraits that one curator describes as Warhol as Hamlet. At this point in time, Warhol begins to change. And in 1963, he had said something. He said, you ought to be able to be an abstract expressionist next week, or a pop artist, or a realist, without feeling you've given up something. I think that would be so great to be able to change styles. Isn't that interesting? Because that's exactly what he starts doing in 1978, and in essence, prefigures this whole notion of a stylist, ahistorical, contemporary art world that we're living and working today. And we see that in his paintings of this period, and it all starts in 1977 in the summer. Now I'm back where I thought I was before. I've caught up with myself. He goes to the opening of the Pompidou in Paris, where Pontus Holton takes him around to the museums of Paris. And he's so excited by seeing all of the great French painting that he writes in his diary. I had energy and wanted to rush home and paint and stop doing society portraits. And at that moment is when he entered on to something of seismic proportions in terms of a change in his work. For the first time, Andy Warhol creates abstract paintings by using the chemical reaction of urine on metallic paint. He creates these absolutely majestic paintings that emulate the overall composition of abstract expressionism, but at the same time parody them. I mean, after all, what can be more of an insult than pissing on a painting, after all? This is what Warhol is doing, combining both at the same time. But it does do one thing that he said throughout his career, that what he was attempting to achieve was the physical presence of painting. And through the process of doing these works, he literally, physically, got himself back into the act of painting, albeit without a paintbrush, but what his studio assistant described as the penis brush. But this moment in time is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, Andy Warhol, after all, is a painter of things, right? He takes images out of pop culture. What does this have to do with Andy Warhol? Interestingly, these were never shown in the United States in his lifetime until the year before he died. They were virtually unknown except for one small gallery show in France in the early 1980s. But the vitality and energy that emanated from these works. Everybody I've talked to who worked with Andy Warhol at this point in time said the enthusiasm was absolutely extraordinary. It was infectious. All Andy wanted to do was to paint. He would leave meetings and leave it up to Vincent and to Fred to conduct the business so he could go in the back room and keep painting. It's at this point when Andy Warhol literally begins to work every day and every night, because he's so moved by the idea of painting. But this is not factory mechanical reproduction. He's entered a new phase, and a phase that I would say is one in which he's embarking on a new work. He wants to do new ideas, in his own word. And with each passing season, each passing week, he comes up with a new method, a new technique, in order to create what I call his personal painting. Paintings that he did for his personal artistic gratification that were very rarely shown in his lifetime. And that's what this show covers, those personal paintings. And excited by what he did here, he wanted to continue on the path of abstraction and decided to do it differently yet again. You know, I break my technology, and I think I just broke it. I'm going to need some help. Thank you. And so he tries it yet again, but this time, in order to create abstraction, he goes back to using precisely the process that he used in making portraits. But instead of taking the portrait of someone's face and painting it, he had his studio assistant set up some mat board in the corner of the studio and lit it with some stage lights and took some Polaroids. And then with these Polaroids had acetates made from which screens could be made. But before screening the canvas, he used a mop. Literally, a kitchen floor mop, and painted blank canvases with all of these rich variations of color. And then after they had dried, screened the image of the shadow on top of them. This particular series, the penultimate series, was done for Heiner Friedrich Gallery in New York. Heiner asked him to produce a series for his gallery, and Andy created 102 of these shadows that wrapped the whole gallery, ringed the walls from door back to the other side of the door. The show was done in early 1978 and caused quite a sensation and shock in the New York art world, but Heiner Friedrich bought them up, and they weren't seen again until after Andy Warhol's death. They're in the Dia Foundation now. He was so enthusiastic, though, about all of these new developments in abstraction that he kept pushing the envelope. He liked the idea that you could create abstract painting without actually painting them, and continued that idea. Yeah, I did break it. You're going to help me? Okay, good. Thank you. He had a portrait. Not only did Warhol do portraits of people, but companies would hire him to do product portrait. And a yarn manufacturer in Italy commissioned him to do a portrait of their yarns. And of course, the yarn people picked some photograph of a spool of yarn with a little string dangling off of the end of it that they bought. But Warhol so loved one of the test Polaroids he did where he strung the yarn across the floor in spaghetti pattern and then silk screened it and creates this marvelous large, it's called the big yarn, we call it in the vernacular, it's about 25 feet wide, you'll see it up here, in which it resembles a very colorful Jackson Pollock. Not surprising when you consider the fact that Warhol did indeed emulate Jackson Pollock, and in fact, when he graduated from Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh in 1949 and moved to New York in August 1949 with his painter friend Philip Perlstein, what does he see in Life magazine but the famous article asking the question, who is the great, is he the greatest living painter in the United States? And what does Warhol seek? Fame and fortune, the name he gave his two dogs. Continuing to push the idea of abstraction. Thank you. Why don't you, come here. You want to hold this for me? This is useless. It doesn't work anymore. You can blame me. I'm a techno boob. I break all this stuff. And it always happens around me. I think it's that electromagnetic field I give off. He's sitting there in the studio, and he asked his studio assistant, Jay Shriver, I need a new idea for a painting. Jay imitates him beautifully, and it's hard to believe that somebody with such a crackly, hesitant voice was the guy who could change our visual culture in the way he did. Jay responds by knowing he wants to do abstract paintings and says, well, why don't we do that old study process we used to do in art school, which was ink blots. And so Jay did a series of little ink blot drawings on pieces of paper. Andy loved the idea and said, okay, now let's do them at 14 to 20 feet in length. And got the whole studio out. They draw out the outline on one side, ink one half, fold these humongous bolts of canvas in half, and then take the cardboard roll the canvas comes on, and everybody in the studio, four, five, six people, hands and knees, rolling out the ink to create these massive Rorschachs, which in their best moments resemble the sort of penetrating psychological content that comes from their namesake, the Rorschach ink test. And when he decides to deal with them in gorgeous gold or in silver sometime, they become these magisterial gates that have an ominous and imposing presence in the room. These pieces really are a dramatic shift and the biggest transformation and metamorphosis of Warhol's work since he introduced the idea of the photo transfer process in 1962. These pictures, brilliant in their conception, monumental in their scale, really announce the arrival of neo-expressionism. I mean, you think about this. January 1979, Warhol shows his shadows. Fall 1979 is when you have the first shows of Julian Schnabel and then Eric Fischel and David Sally, and we have the rebirth of big, bold, bright, thick impasto painting. Warhol is on the cusp of that. Bruno Bischofberger recognizes Warhol's role in that and invites one of the young artists of the group to come to Warhol's studio for lunch one day, Jean-Michel Basquiat. And in the process, Warhol and Basquiat hit it off. There's a fabulous story about how when Warhol liked somebody, he would take your Polaroid after lunch and then paint a portrait and give it to you as a gift. Well, Basquiat, in his brazenness and daring, had a picture taken of both he and Warhol, left before lunch was served, and ran back when lunch was finishing with a finished canvas. Warhol was shaken by this. My God, this kid paints faster than I do. I mean, after all, he saw himself as the pinnacle of painting in the New York art world. And that began a two-year relationship where Basquiat would come by in the morning after he recovered from his nightly excesses, and they would paint together in the studio. Warhol typically laying down some of his grounds and screen, and then Basquiat coming along and painting over them. There's a fabulous example, Sin Moore upstairs, which I don't have a slide of, but which you will see. As they progressed over time, they began to develop a sort of syncopated dialogue in which, as Warhol said, the paintings he liked best were the one that you couldn't tell who did what. And in this case, this is the fish that got away. This is the one that Warhol said was the greatest of collaborations and was the masterpiece. I couldn't squeeze it out of the man's house for the show. I'm sorry. But this is called African Mask. And what you see here, it's very difficult from the image to tell apart. But what you see is Warhol and Basquiat both hand-painting, Basquiat sometimes screening, a black face and then a white face and a black face and a white face, playing off of one another. Warhol trying to look like Basquiat's rough touch, but he's much too facile and accomplished a painter. Basquiat trying to do some of the screen and adopt the sort of handwork that is Andy Warhol, is one of the great technicians of the 20th century. It's in work like this where we see how Basquiat completely opened up Warhol's idea of painting by hand again. And in fact, Andy says, Jean-Michel got me into painting different, so that's a good thing. And that good thing was not just painting by hand, but figure painting by hand. After this period of abstraction, Warhol went back to the brush, went back to figure painting, and painting by hand again. Now, Bruno Bischofberger and Shafrazi got together and did a show of these in New York in 1985, and the New York Times Review was not kind. They described Basquiat as Warhol's mascot, and that his career would be ruined if he continued to consort with this old dean of the art world, and that Warhol was trying to prop his failing career up on the backs of this young, promising painter. Well, basically, that ended the relationship. Basquiat didn't come around anymore and paint. Warhol was crushed because they had developed a very close personal relationship. In a sense, Warhol sort of felt paternal. After they would paint in the daytime, they would go out together and do all the clubs at night. But the influence of Basquiat is lasting in these final works, these final years of Warhol's career. And influenced by these, he began to do his black and white ads. Now, these are very interesting because they look back to the idea of pop art. The earliest pop painting were these black and white hand-painted pop images. What he would do to create these is he would sketch out on a piece of paper in ink with a brush and paint these drawings, photograph the drawing, and then have them silkscreened. And when you look at them, and I want you to do so when you see the show, what he's doing is he's playing with the notion of hand painting and silkscreen printing. You can see the drips and smears in these, but that's a screen print. He also, in the next one, reveals for the first time in these works, and none of these black and white ads were ever shown in his lifetime, he reveals his personal religious sentiments, something that he had privately been practicing. Warhol went to Mass every week, worked in the soup kitchen, and went to, during the middle of the week as well, to do his prayers in the Orthodox Church. And here he begins to appropriate evangelical tone ad that hint at his own private religious beliefs. But what makes the black and white ads so amazing is when we see how on the biggest ones he actually paints them completely by hand. In these works, he takes the logos and the ads, he projects them onto the screen, and then in freehand paints over them with black acrylic paint and a brush. Now, when you go up in the show and you look at them, you should try to figure out which are hand painted and which are screened. It's very difficult to do. And what Warhol, in my mind, is doing is trying to develop a sort of new twist on the expression trompe l'oeil, which means to fool the eye. And here, he's fooling your eye. The prototypical mechanical reproduction master of images is reproducing his own drawing, and sometimes painting with an absolute virtuoso flourish that is spectacular. I'm not going to, well, you already know this one's hand-painted. Okay, I gave one away, but I'm not giving any more away. You got to figure those out on your own. That's a test, and at the end of the day, we're going to take a test and see who gets them right, okay? See, I have recovered from being a museum director. I am now full-fledged academic because I think in terms of giving tests. 1986. Basically, the end of 1985 through 1986, Warhol is the busiest he's ever been in his entire career. He's working on more painting commissions. He's doing his private painting. He's doing several television sets. He's producing more prints. He's a fashion model. He is working literally every day of the week, cranking stuff out. But it's also a period of time of great emotional distress. He just lost his best friend. Jean-Michel won't come around anymore because he's a mascot. And that hurt him greatly. His partner was dying of AIDS. Warhol never spoke to anybody about that. In fact, nobody knew that the man had died until many months after it had happened. It was such a private thing to him. And Warhol also recognized that his own health was failing. He was very frail. Since that gunshot, he was always very frail. As a boy, he was a sickly boy. After the gunshot, he had lots of internal issues. He would box with Jean-Michel. He could do 50 push-ups, but his insides were very weak and frail, and he knew it. And the people who worked there said, but he was there every day, every night, cranking out these absolutely massive and monumental pieces. During that period, there are three series that really stand out for me: the Freitag self-portraits, the camouflage painting, and the Last Supper paintings. Arguably, the Freitag is the signature self-portrait of Andy Warhol. Of all the late works and personal works, this is one that is very well known. It was exhibited in London in 1986, and what he did to do these self-portraits, again, these are the first self-portraits since those 1978 ones. He did some small ones as part of the Myth series that you'll see up there, but these really are his big statement of his self-image. He's presenting himself to us to be seen in a particular way. Warhol was a master at manipulating his image and his persona. This has nothing to do with that early Warhol who was the pop idol in the 1960s. Here we see a man gaping open mouth, I think I have another one here for you with which I hope you're familiar. That it, gaping open mouth, dark, deeply sunken eyes that reads like a death mask, or, as some have pointed out, like Veronica's veil. This is a man reflecting on his life and his mortality. He did these with his assistant Benjamin. He asked Benjamin to do his hair. Andy, one of the things that Andy never let anybody touch him. Never anybody. Those crowds of people around Andy Warhol, it was all about keeping people away from him. He was afraid of being touched. And so for Benjamin to be allowed to do his wig was a big thing. And he asked Benjamin to fluff up his wig like Jean-Michel's Rasta haircut. And then had Polaroid shot of him. There are five variations on this, on these Polaroids that show Warhol looking at himself at this moment in life. The camouflage pictures was probably the most popular theme of his late work. The camouflage appears in self-portraits, Last Supper. It appears in Statue of Liberty pictures. It appears more than any of his other late motifs. The camouflage again came from his studio assistant, Jay. He said, Jay, what are you doing? And Jay said he was painting army camouflage. Warhol loved the idea, sent him to the army surplus store. He got a patch, and they worked out a pattern from which Warhol expanded to gargantuan length. When you see a camouflage painting now, though, you need to remember that this is a piece of decoration for him, just like the self-portrait wallpaper in the show, just like the cow wallpaper. His idea for the camouflage was never realized. What he wanted to do was to make these vast expanses. There are some of these camouflage pictures that are 40 feet wide, and his intention was to hang those from wall to wall, just like the shadow installation, and then hang the smaller camouflage painting on top of them, so you'd have this depth of camouflage pattern. But that was never realized. However, what Warhol did find in the camouflage pattern was a sort of Duchampian ready-made abstraction with military overtone and overtones of deception. But the greatest, most ambitious series of works in his entire career, yes, the flowers are greater in number, but there were none that approached the absolutely monumental scale and the infinite variety of technique and application and motifs, composition, as The Last Supper. The Last Supper came about because a dealer, Alexander Iolas, had just purchased a gallery right across the street in Milan from where Leonardo's masterpiece was. Now, it's interesting how things come full circle, because Alexander Iolas gave Andy Warhol his first exhibition in 1952, an exhibition of drawings after Truman Capote's Literature. And here, as it turns out, Alexander Iolas gives Warhol his last exhibition. Iolas had asked a number of artists if they would be willing to work on the subject of Leonardo's Last Supper. Only Warhol accepted the commission, and in fact, the subject obsessed him, as we would find out. He worked over a year, literally producing hundreds and hundreds of painting, drawing, and prints in infinite variation on the Last Supper, such as this large double silkscreen Last Supper that is in the Baltimore Museum of Art. His exhibition opened in Christmas of 1986 and continued into the new year. And this was really the first public presentation of Warhol's religious beliefs. And these beliefs, he was raised in an Eastern Orthodox church. His mother practiced it and taught him, and he practiced it during his career. But in the last interview he gave, he said quite the opposite. These had absolutely no sentimental value. He said, "I'm still a commercial artist. I was always a commercial artist." Next one. Shortly after this interview, Warhol was scheduled to do a fashion shoot with Miles Davis at the Tunnel Club, Hip East Village Club. The photographer and videographer recording the proceeding noticed that Warhol was more pale and gaunt than usual, and as he walked onto the stage, he winced visibly and made very painful noises. He struggled to complete the session, but he was a workaholic. He was going to complete the session, but the next day, on the advice of his close assistant, he checked into the hospital for emergency gallbladder surgery. The surgery was successful, but then 2 days later, he dies suddenly. It's never been publicly stated. Lawsuits and litigation ensued. Both the hospital and the foundation have agreed not to discuss it, but it was very clearly an act of malpractice that was directed at a particular nurse who was fired. You don't die from gallbladder surgery, but Warhol did. And his demise was sudden and really a shock to all of those people. It's interesting to me that Warhol lived a very short life, really, for having had such a long career. And in his eulogy at the memorial service, John Richardson, an art historian, read something that stunned the legions of audiences that filled the aisles of the nave. He said, "The spiritual side of Warhol that he hid from all but his closest friend is the key to the artist's psyche." It was only at this moment that people began to realize there was another side to Warhol than the society person that we saw in the tabloids. And in fact, when they opened the door to his studio, they found that his studio was dominated by these massive Last Supper paintings that he continued to paint, even though he had fulfilled the relatively small commission that Alexander Aeolus had created for him. Through these series of Last Suppers, the delicately laid lines painted on a greater scale than he had ever painted, we see Warhol at his greatest mastery. Can I have the next one, please? Despite his public proclamations to the contrary, it's very clear that the Last Supper was a very personal painting for Warhol. The image of Christ and his disciples possessed him. For an artist who was obsessed from those very early disasters painting with the subject of death, the subject of the Lord's final repast constitutes the consummate disaster painting. For over a year, working on these things, weekends, nights, and evenings, he created some of the most monumental works of the 20th century. He said, "I painted them all by hand, I myself, so now I've become a Sunday painter. That's why the project took so long, but I worked with a passion." He's a good Catholic boy. When he chooses the word passion, he knows what he's saying. And I hear what he's saying. And it's interesting to me that in this new interest in figure painting, literally, with a brush, and his former interest in commercial logos and silk screening, he combines the breadth of his technical abilities. The symbols are not just the irony of typical pop, but certainly the wise potato chip owl in the upper right is certainly the wisdom and knowledge of Christ. The big C is a sort of vernacular way to describe Christ. He took it from a headline in a newspaper that was talking about cure for cancer, the big C being cancer, which at that point in time, remember, AIDS was considered the gay cancer. There are relationships in these works to many different subjects. And when we see the profound images and the significance of the iconography that Warhol puts into these, we remember the young artist who in 1962 aspired to create the symbols that sustain us. His last hand-painted Last Suppers, can I have one more? I think I have one more, yes. We see him combining his technical virtuosity the hand drawing, and I beg of you to look very closely. These are painted from freehand from projection onto the wall. The technical virtuosity of his handwork is absolutely extraordinary, and mark these works as some of the greatest drawings as well as painting of the 20th century. His ability in these works, whether it's the screened images like Baltimore's or the hand-painted ones like the Andy Warhol Museum, demonstrate an artist at the full capacity of his powers, who only late in his career was able to summon up all of the various techniques that he had mastered: photo transfers, logos, projections, silk screening, and painting by hand with a brush into this consummate tour de force that marks Andy Warhol's last work. And it was work. The word work is very applicable to a man who was obsessed with working. And he says in his diary, at about this point in time, he asked, "What is art? Does it really come out of you, or is it a product?" Thank you. You know, if you want to ask me something, you're welcome to. I'll give you a couple minutes if you want. Would you rather see the show? A bashful crowd? We have a question there. I'm going to need your help.
This is our ghost of process. I don't know what there is about this, but you want to know the process a lot with these works. And that's that big silk screen of Vesuvius upstairs. And I kind of, you know, it's so expressionistically...
Not a silk screen.
What?
Not a silk screen. Now you know two of them are hand-painted. It actually isn't even a black and white ad, but I loved the painting so much I stuck it in there anyway.
It's a painting because I thought it said yeah. Silk screen.
Yeah, it does, because the Warhol Museum couldn't tell the difference, and the registrar put that into the database, and by contract, the label has to say what the Warhol Museum database says. But the curators and I all agree that's a hand-painted, freehand painting.
Okay, so it was painted at that scale. That was my question, whether it was a serigraph, it was...
He had an overhead projector, and he could determine the scale by how far or close he moved the projector. And that's how he got the scale.
So the first image was small, projected, and then he painted over the projection.
The small ones are actually brush-painted sheets of paper that are photoed and silk-screened. Only the bigger ones are hand-painted.
That's what he's asking.
Yes. They sit in files. He had files of clippings from magazines and stuff that he used as source material. And many of these do go back to the 60s. He actually went back to his old files and pulled out the source material.
You know, when I look at it, I kind of think of Franz Klein. Like if you looked at a portion of it, it would look like a Franz Klein.
Yeah. That works.
How were the last supper paintings received in Italy?
That's a really good question, and I don't read Italian, so it's very hard for me to judge the earnestness. I paid somebody to translate. They were not terribly enthusiastic because everyone expects Warhol to be ironic. I know the first time I saw the Last Suppers at the Guggenheim 15 or 20 years ago, I couldn't bring myself to believe that this guy was actually a religious person. I mean, you know, and carry on like he did. But in fact, that was the response. Somebody else?
The work seems to be inextricably tied to the culture that he's in. For someone of a younger generation that hasn't experienced the change and physically seen the 80s and the decades, how would you recommend going about studying or reading to get enough?
Are you an artist?
Photographer.
Then you look at the way they're made. Start by looking at the way they're made. Warhol is an absolutely extraordinary technician. He wanted to be the very best. And if you, and this great story of a collector friend, Robert Pincus Witten, some of you may have heard his name, used to be editor of Art Forum, helped a woman in New York build a collection of drawings by Henri Matisse and Andy Warhol. And she hung them in a corner of her apartment building, all mixed together, bunches of them. And we were there for an event, and Robert Pincus Witten couldn't tell them all apart. He is that good of a draftsman that he could compare with Henri Matisse. So look at them for their technique. Or look at the Vesuvius painting this gentleman talking about. It's flat out a beautiful one. If you know any painters, ask them how the painted ones were done. It's an extraordinary technique. And it's amazing to me because when I look at the revival of painting that's going on right now, all young painters should go see this stuff and see the total scope of work. If you just took one type of work from Andy Warhol's last decade, just one type of his work, let's just say the screened works, there's more accomplishment in one of those lines than most artists create in their whole careers. Any other questions? Thank you.